Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill. Welcome to another episode of the Plant Cunning Podcast. Today, we're interviewing Norio Kushi. And I first met him at a TAT Foundation event. Other TAT-affiliated people that we've interviewed are Art Tickner, Tess Hughes, and Arnim Upon Deer. And you can check out those episodes if you're interested by this sort of thing. You can also find TAT at tatfoundation.org. So, Norio is also the son of Michio and Aveline Kushi, who were big in the macrobiotic movement and founded some of the first health food stores in the U.S. And he's had a very interesting life, which you can read about in Awake at the Wheel, which is a book that was written about his life. Before we get to the episode, we just have a few weeks left until the Plant Cutting Conference, and we only have a few tickets left. So if you have been thinking about getting a ticket, do so soon. You can get one at plantcunningconference.com. And the Plant Cunning Conference is being sponsored by Woodland Essence and Maple Creative, which are both wonderful companies you can check out at woodlandessence.com and buildwithmaple.com. Okay, well, let's get to the episode. Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we are honored to have Norio Kushi. And I first met Norio a few years ago at a TAT conference. TAT is an organization that promotes awakening and enlightenment and the spiritual search. And I've interviewed Art Tickner, Tess Hughes, and Arnim Upon Deer before, so you can go back to those recordings if you're interested by this. But Norio is a fantastic individual. Very pleased to speak with him. And Norio, how are you today?
I'm doing great. My life is like a roller coaster. It's up and down, and it's an interesting journey. As you know, I was diagnosed with cancer at August 2021. And, you know, I mean, to me, the word cancer is not negative or scary at all. So I just, you know, to me, whatever's showing up, whatever the universe is, however the universe is playing, I know that the universe is infinitely wise, where I know maybe not even a fraction, barely anything compared. So I know that it's operating perfectly. So I just take it all in and play with it. And it's been it's been very insightful. I've really appreciated it. It's happening, coming into my life. So.
Wow. That's a very powerful statement for most people. I don't think most people could say something like that.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, just to have that level of trust and everything working out or being the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, for sure. We the way we live, we tend to do a lot of arguing with the universe. you know who's going to win in the end.
That's very true. Yeah. So when we interviewed Art and Tess and Arnima, I started the questioning off with Richard Rowe's question, which was, what do you know for sure? So Norio, do you know for sure?
That's a great question.
Yeah, just an easy lowball question to start you out, you know.
I recently started reading Richard Rowe. I guess, is it the 50th anniversary of when he founded TAT?
Yeah, this year.
I'm going to be a presenter on the upcoming event, August. So I thought, well, why not find out a little bit about the founder? And I started reading his work, and I'm impressed. I'm impressed with his work. I definitely resonate with a lot of what he's said. And I love the Jacob's Ladder analogy that he uses. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good analogy. And between this and all these things, which I've heard the terms thrown around, the TAT organization, that I never understood exactly what they meant, but now reading his work, I see what he's pointing to. And not that I understand, I can't claim to understand it fully, but I really appreciate it. more than anything else. And then where was I going? Your question. Yeah, I have a similar question I like to ask people is, how do you know what you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you know what you know? That's a question I like to ask. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I'm looking for an answer to. It's more like I want people to really consider that. So I could give you the answer, but it's not going to mean anything. And that makes no sense. That's what I call what I say, Norio nonsense, I call it. So anyway, what do I know for certain? What I know for certain is there's no beginning, no end. There's no end to life. That's the only thing I know for certain. There's no beginning, there's no end.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, I'm clueless.
So, what are you?
None of that. In 2005, what I recognized is that the core of all realities, and I say that in plural, reality in plural, like the realities of insects, the realities of trees, realities of plants, realities of other beings, realities of planets, et cetera, et cetera. At the core of all of that is the infinite. And that is the foundation of our being and the being of everything. And so ultimately everything is an expression of that. And so how this reality, all realities are created is through vibration, energy, first vibration, which turns into light, which then combines, turns into energy, which then can form the material world, of what we perceive as the material world. So the way all realities are created is through what I call languaging. And I don't say language, I'd say languaging, because there's actually nothing, it's everything that, other than the timeless, everything else is a one flow, continuous movement. And it's all, so as humans, we also language and we speak in nouns, like I'm looking at this, at the two of you through this camera on this computer on this table. So the computer, table, the house that I'm in, the floor, it's all of those are language phenomena. So, but it's all temporary. It's arising and it's coming from the nothing and going back to nothing. So everything is actually in motion. So that's why I say language, and language is in motion. So who am I? What are you? Who am I? It's pointing to a temporary phenomenon, a noun, pronoun, me, proper noun, Noria. So that is a temporary form. That's a temporary label, which I go through, which this form is in existence, is using that label. But what is animating and creating this form is the same thing, which is the animating, creating Isaac and AC. And the form itself is temporary. What we are can never is something that pre-exists language. Pre-exists the concept of you, me, our, etc. It's now now that we have this human form, we speak though at that way. And the mischief is that we're identifying with the form. And that's where humans get into mischief. It's forgotten at our core, where our core is infinite or eternal, no beginning, no end. So, and then we play in the temporal. So the temporal is an expression of the eternal. And so, and our forms are aspects of the temporal. So the cosmic joke is that we're never not, we have everything we could ever want. We never don't ever have it. We never did not ever have it. So, you know, the eternal, there's never, if you think of the eternal, it's always here. It's all, and always was and always will be, right? So we go through life feeling like something's missing, you know, like, and I got to fix myself. I got to get better, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing wrong with any of that. That's playing in their temporal, you know, but so the mischief is we identify with that character, the temporary character in this temporal world. And it's possible to directly know, you know, have one foot in the eternal and one foot in the temporal, and have a lot of fun in the temporal. So regardless of whether diagnosed with cancer or not, it's all playing in the temporal. and the cancer, that's just an interpretation. It's not a good or bad or right or wrong.
What happened in 2005? You mentioned 2005, there was like a shift, or you had a moment of realization. Like what was that all about?
Well, in September 2002, I started driving the truck in 1980. So, and then I did many other things in between. I actually started a bus company in Vermont. I did a lot of things. I love wheels. I grew up bicycling, and I did my first overnight trip when I was 14. I went 600 miles from Boston to Montreal back. So 2002, I had been let go. I was fired from one job, and I was looking. I had sent out resumes and looking at different companies. I had just come back from an interview with a company in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I come into the house, and Joanne is there, who I was married to at the time, but we were actually split up, but we're still together in the house, leaving the house. And I told her, well, I thought the interview went okay and everything. So in that moment, as I describe that to her, then I'm thinking, what should I do? Should I send out more interview, you know, more resumes, et cetera? And I'm looking out the window of the kitchen, and I'm looking out at the trees in our yard. And all of a sudden, I saw that life is not going to turn out. Okay. Now that may sound negative, but actually it was very positive. What occurred as a result of this realization, and I could say there was a knowing of this. And I mean, throughout my life, my mother was my first teacher, and she always told me to, she when I was 5 years old, said, trust your feeling. And she didn't mean emotion. She said feeling. And I knew it as a child. That's the way she lived, so I knew exactly what she meant. So this was one of those instances where you tune into your feelings when your body's fully open. You know, emotions are the opposite. Emotions you feel in different, or more of a restriction in different parts of the body. Feelings from the universe, whatever you tune into when your body's relaxed and open. So there's this, looking at the trees, I just felt this feeling. And as the feeling moved through the body into the intellect, the words that came out was, life is not going to turn out. Okay. So, and anytime that occurs, it's like, it's a certainty. I know it absolutely. And it's a shift. So from that moment on, I stopped living for a future. And I didn't recognize at the time, but we've been conditioned or programmed to live for a future, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's something that doesn't have to do with any of us individually. Being human, being born in this world today, particularly in our culture, we're programmed to live for some future, you know, like a carrot and stick, like a donkey, you know, with the carrot and stick. Mm-hmm. And like the donkey with the carrot and stick, he never gets closer to the carrot. So once I saw that it felt like I didn't realize how much energy I was putting to living for the future. Mm-hmm. And so it was like 40 pounds of weight came off my shoulder. And I knew that from that moment on, I've never had to make a decision since 2002. Because unbeknownst to us, anytime we have to make a decision, it's because we have a future goal.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out how are we going to get to this future goal. And which is, I have to decide, which is what's going to get me there. However, in stopping living for future, every step is right there. In every moment, the next step is there. You know, so one instant, I'm wondering, should I send out a resume? Should I, you know, whatever. In the next moment, once I see that, I say, oh my God, I know exactly what to do. I love driving. I love driving trucks. I can make plenty of money to support the family, pay the mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just go back to driving the truck because I love to do that anyway. It was a no-brainer.
These thoughts are always in our head. Well, yeah. not always for in your case anymore. But
yeah.
Thinking about the future, trying to decide and plan and scheme, and that locks us into this plane of the decisions. But when you're, well, it seems also like you in particular are open to your intuition and your body and your feelings a lot more than a lot of people, like especially me. But so when you said that the words that came across was that the future isn't going to turn out or my life isn't going to turn out, that was like all of your preconceived notions about what you wanted to be, the idea of yourself as like rich and prosperous. And then once reality set in that that's not going to be your future, then you allowed yourself to just accept the life that you had.
It's I wouldn't describe it exactly like that, but yeah. Okay. It's I mean, it could be described in that way, but it's definitely it wasn't that what I was chasing was futile. I just, the idea of living for a future was ended. So yeah. Of course I still had to make money, and you know, I still, you know,
right,
build the mortgages, et cetera. So
but just the all of those preconceived notions and those projections into the future of what you wanted to right. be, what you wanted to do, all of that just fell away in an instant.
Right, exactly. In an instant. All that fell away.
That's pretty amazing.
And one thing, and I was never interested in what is called spirituality. So so it wasn't like replaced with spirituality, you know, or anything like that. It was just that way of living for a future just ended. So subsequently, I got back into driving a truck. It took a while to get back into the rhythm of that. And in February or March of 2004, I started asking the question, okay, what does it mean to be human? And once I started asking that question, all these insights into our humanity started showing up. And in February 2005, as one insight after another, it started dissolving all my preconceived ideas of what I am, the programming. And 2005, I discovered what thinking is. And in recognizing what thinking is, the thinking could stop. Mm-hmm. And so for prolonged periods, so 2 weeks I went without any thought.
So what, wow. What is thinking?
You have to see it. You have to see okay. it. Or whatever. Or, I don't
know. You have to experience it.
Yeah. If we examine what thinking is talking to itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Images and talking to itself, right? So if you think about an infant, when the infant is first born, the infant actually doesn't think at all. The infant doesn't start thinking until it starts speaking.
Uh-huh.
When the child becomes a toddler and then starts speaking whatever, you know, the cultural language. In my case, it was Japanese, actually. And even though I was born in New York City, and then later I learned English as well. So prior to that, an infant is not disconnected from the eternal. To the infant, there is nothing but the eternal. I mean, it doesn't have a concept of internal or temporal or anything like that. It's just mm-hmm. it's in the moment. You know? And so then once it begins to speak, then it starts to develop ideas in language, things, nouns. And then it starts to identify with a thing. That's all that this thing is what I am. You know, so if we look at thinking is that continuation of the languaging. It's running automatically within what we think is within this character. And the cosmic joke is that there's nobody that's thinking. In the same way the infant was not thinking. It's the infant human, when the toddler learns thinking, but everything that can be identified with is only in the language. But our existence and our ground of being is pre-thinking, pre-language. So everything we think we are and identify with is only in the inherited ideas in our thinking. So thinking is languaging to oneself. So once the thinking stops, then the distinctions making, we don't recognize that the separation is only in thinking, is only in languaging. So it's, and since we're constantly talking to them, the talking is constantly running. The way the world is showing up for us is separate things, separate events, etc. So after 4 days of the silence of no thinking, I say I got hit with the cosmic 2x4, which is that I saw that everything I thought I was is only in language. It's only in thinking and talking. Mm-hmm. And when the talking and thinking ended, everything I am and was no longer there. It's only a linguistic distinction. Hmm. You know, but of course I didn't disappear. You know, there was still, and what I discovered is I could actually drive the truck easier, so much better without the distraction of all this thinking. I was so much more aware, alert at that moment by moment than with this chatter going.
Yeah.
So once I was seen, then of course I said, oh my God, you know, then like everything that I ever wanted prior to recognizing life was not going to turn out, I saw I already have all that. I never not had that. And I said, oh my God, I need to share this with friends, family. So here I am.
Yeah.
Attempting to once again to share. And what I end up doing is confusing people more than anything else.
It's great, though. I think people will get the gems that they need to, you know, out of the Norio nonsense, as you call it. But it's very interesting to us. So I'm curious, though, if you could speak a little bit more to how driving is like its own meditation to you, and what you love about driving and how you can get into that like flow state while driving.
Yeah, driving is, well, wheels, period. I just love wheels. Mm-hmm. Even when I was bicycling, you know, mm-hmm. I learned a lot of things about talking to oneself. Mm-hmm. As I'm bicycling, I could see, you know, like coming back from Montreal, I was going through Vermont, for example, and I was climbing this hill. It was August, it was 90 degrees.
Wow.
Nearly 100% humidity. Mm-hmm. Climbing this hill out of Barrie, Vermont. And then I take a right on 110 South, and I thought that that would be the top of the hill. I get to there, take a right, and then I just see the big hill continue. You know, I was miserable. I was suffering. And finally, I do get to the top, and the road turns to the left. And right there's a gas station on the left-hand side. And got a soda machine, or a dime in the soda machine. Have a nice orange soda, and the orange soda, and I felt great. Mm-hmm. So as I'm enjoying that, then I noticed, wow, what a difference compared to how it was before.
Yeah,
I feel so wonderful. Before I was suffering, I came totally suffering.
Yeah,
I wanted to give up. I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. But so I looked at it. I said, oh, this is it's interesting, the contrast. And then as I looked at it, I saw, oh, it had nothing to do with the hill or the heat. It had to do with this hamster wheel way of talking to the next stop. Mm-hmm. And so I saw, oh, okay. So since then, heat has never bothered me for the rest of my life. And the hill, and I developed a way of bicycling uphill. I could go 30 miles up the hill.
Wow.
With virtually no effort. I just get into this rhythm, both states. And it just, you know, like I was going across the Rocky Mountain National Park and one time, and I'm at the base and I'm just in the groove, you know, just climbing this hill, like, I don't know, 25 miles to the top, whatever. And this ranger comes up, pulls up next to me and says, you better slow down. You're never going to make it.
Wow.
You're never going to make it. So I said, well, thank you. You know, I just thank the ranger. Thank you. Ranger to go. I knew that I'd make it, no problem.
Yeah.
So, So
driving is always like that for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I never considered driving meditation. The only time I consciously meditated was when I was 10 years old. My dad would give these classes. And so I'd sit in and he was teaching meditation for one class. And so the next day I got up and, oh, I'm going to try it. I sat on the couch and I sat there for about 10 minutes. And, enough of that. I want to go out and play.
Yeah.
That was the end of my meditation. So yeah, so after that, I never considered driving a meditation or a bicycle meditation, but I realized it's definitely meditation.
Well, yeah, I think different people are suited to different kinds of practices too.
Yeah.
And like, it's good to have something where your attention is, you have to have some level of attention to like, yeah, make sure you don't crash into a car or something, or you're focused on the breath. Or whatever it is, but be able to then use the attention in other ways to follow these explorations that you did into what it means to be human and so on. But you also have a very like feeling oriented character, it seems, you know. and I'm curious if you think that. So it's like the languaging and the mind is what separates us from knowing what we are at our core, right? And there are some people who have gotten to that point of knowing what they are at their core through thousands of hours of meditation, mm-hmm. for instance, or prayer or whatever it is. But and I know some people like Art, for instance, for him, thought was a part of his path. And so when he had his big breakthrough, thought was happening, but it wasn't like he didn't get to a point of no thought. It just wasn't a problem for him. It was still happening, but it wasn't the main part of his attention. And then also people like Franklin Merrill Wolfe had the idea in his writings talk about how you can like transcend thought in a certain way. And if you use thought to get there, then, you know, that's also a valid way. But it seems like there's a lot of different ways. In fact, there's different way for every person.
Yeah.
But do you think everyone's reaching the same point? Like, are there multiple, is there one mountain or are there many mountains? Is each person a mountain or what? Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, there's different, what I would say is there's different ways of describing.
Okay.
And so the thing is that eternal is always here now, and always was and always will be.
Right.
And most people like myself, until I was 50, until I got the cosmic joke, was unaware of it. And unaware that. So what I can say is that either way, everybody's already here. Nobody cannot be here.
Mm-hmm.
Not be in the eternal. Nobody is not the, so all it is the attention is on the temporal world. Okay. The temporal world is mesmerizing. It's whatever. It's so 100% of the attention is in this temporary world. And
hypnotized by it.
Yeah. So the realization of it is that to see that it was always here and always will be. And that occurs when the identifying with a aspect of the temporal called Noria, and when that identifying, and to identify with anything, we need to have language to make it, to point to a tree. Hey, is that a tree? We need to have the words, language. We need to have the noun. What is languaging is just a form of play. And it turns out that all the thinking that's going on, what we think is thinking is program. There's actually no one that's doing the thinking. Everything you think you are is a thought. It's just another thought.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the identifying with this fragment within the thinking that then puts our attention in this world of concepts and the temporal world reality. So it's a question of it's not a place to get to. And this is what it means by backing away. You start peeling away. So like 2002, when I saw that life was not going to turn out, one of the things that's in the way, one of the things which captivates us is the idea of time.
Mm.
We don't recognize time is created in languaging.
Mm-hmm.
In the speaking, and we as human forms, actually time is created through our human form. It's not so the thinking, what I saw was like clouds in the sky, nothing wrong with it, but I'm not thinking. There isn't a thinker. It's like
thinking is happening.
Yeah, thinking is just happening in the same way clouds in the sky are. It's a natural phenomenon in the sky. I don't own the clouds. Thinking is a natural phenomenon. I don't own the thinking. I'm not the one that's thinking. The way I'm thinking is the way that I've been. It's a way that I inherited, culturally inherited way of thinking. In the talking, in English, images, etc. So. And, you know, if I was born in, born to Japanese parents, originally I spoke, my thinking was in Japanese, but you know, if I was born in Spain, I'd be speaking Spanish. So what Art and Franklin Merrill Wolfe, what they're pointing to is what was recognized as well, is that there isn't a thinker that's thinking. There's only thinking. And nobody owns it. Nobody's doing it. It's happening through the human form. But that's one of the things that human brains does think. But it's not personal. It's nothing to do with the individual form. I don't know. Hopefully
yeah, no,
too much. But
no, that totally makes sense. And like what you said about time as being like a human construct too, because it is pretty exhausting to try to keep track of time stuff, you know, yeah. Like we have these calendars and these reminders and things like that, because it is just like an abstract thought form.
But at the same time, like we identify with this being that was born and is going to die. And so time is this very real experience, you know, of this aging body, this, you know. And time sort of is underneath all, to my way of seeing everything else, because it things can't happen without movement. I guess movement and time are the same thing.
Time space. Time space is one energy flowing, and then through language they split up time space. And thank goodness that we can do that. Otherwise we couldn't agree to meet at 11 a.m. Eastern time.
Right.
And you know, so it's a way of playing in the temporary, in the temporal world.
Right.
You know, so thank goodness we can play that way.
Yeah. So what do you think, I guess, allows some people to understand the cosmic joke and some people don't?
Well, it's not an understanding, it's a seeing. I call it a seeing. And I call it a cosmic joke. It's because everything we're striving for, we already have. You know, we don't know that. I mean, you know, like I had this idea, I was going to have $15 million. I was going to have a modest home with a big barn for all my wheels, you know, things like that. So, but what is it that, why is it that I want those? It's because it gives me certain pleasure. It's an image, you know, I want to be successful in the eyes of my parents, and successful in, et cetera. So, and why do I want to be successful? It's because there's as identifying with a separate me, there's an emptiness as we go through life, you know, something missing. And so what's motivating us is an underlying fear, which I didn't know was there until it was gone. There's an underlying fear in our existence because we're identifying with a temporary form or temporary idea. Even people who say, oh, I'm not the body, regardless, they're identifying with something that's temporary. So anything that's temporary has a beginning and end.
Right.
So it's not that you now identify, I don't identify with the infinite. All identifying ends, period. So there's no longer, and in that, no longer, and that, with no longer identifying with anything, then it's like I said earlier, a metaphor, you know, one foot's in the eternal, one foot's in the temporal. Because there's no longer an identifying. Now I play that way. Like, you know, you call me, hey, Noria, I'm not going to ignore you. You know, what are you saying? You know, we don't have to introduce each other every single time we meet, or, you know, so like time, we just play with it.
So another thing that I'd really like to get to while we have time is the story of this temporary character in this cosmic game and joke and play. So you're actually born to a very interesting family. Your parents were the not the founders of macrobiotics, but the popularizers of macrobiotics in the U.S. and in the 60s and so on. You were born into that milieu of in this alternative health and diet and medicine thing. And I think it's just a very interesting area. And I think our listeners would like to hear more about your background too. And you said that your mom told you at a certain point to just always trust your feelings.
Yeah. Right.
That's not necessarily a normal thing for moms to do. Like you, when you walked out of school, you were allowed to do that.
Right. Yeah. Cause so, I was trusting my feelings and my mother, she asked me, I was 15 when I walked home and I told my mother I'm finished with school. She didn't ask me a question.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what was it like growing up in that milieu?
Well, it's a tough question to answer because that's all I knew.
Right. And maybe that's also why you didn't think about spirituality as something you're interested in, because you were like steeped in it.
Yeah. Well, I think that I consider my mother my first teacher.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean by that, she's the one who laid the groundwork of how I navigate the world. Mm-hmm. My second teacher is George Osau, who is the one who came up with the word macrobiotic. Mm-hmm. His philosophy was something he himself learned through other teachers, et cetera, prior to him. But he refined it and started calling it macrobiotics in the 1950s. And then my third teacher is my dad, of course. So the way I was raised is I was raised eating a particular way. And I didn't know any different. Like, we didn't have any meat in our house. We had no dairy. We had nothing frozen. Mm-hmm. Nothing in cans. Mm-hmm. Everything was fresh, or like dry, commodity, grains, mm-hmm. beans, etc., fresh vegetables, pickles, and so that's how I was raised. I didn't have meat till the first time I had a hard boiled egg was in fourth grade. Someone gave me something like that. So anyway, and. When my dad, when I was 10 years old, became active in the teaching of this quote macrobiotic. And we were living in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time. And my dad would give talks at Harvard. And then in our house, regularly people, and we have dinners. And they, we had a lot of quote students, they might, be part of Timothy Leary's group, and they may come over for dinner or whatever. It's like, it was an interesting time. I mean,
yeah, this was the 60s, right? Yeah. Like, this is the early mid 60s when all this ferment was happening in the US.
Yeah. And one of the Timothy Leary's quote students lived with us. You know?
Wow.
So there were a lot of musicians, Jim Queskin and Jug Band. Joan Baez, her sister Mimi, and Mimi's husband Richard. And there's a lot of musicians that in the music scene that would come over for dinner and stuff too, as well.
Wow. Nice.
I'm 10 years old. I don't know any different to me. I don't know who's who. I just find out later that these are the kind of people that were there. So in conjunction with that, my mother wanted to offer the foods that we ate for sale, and she would buy them in bulk. And as a kid, I would package them up in the basement, et cetera. And then people could buy them, these Japanese, like umeboshi, shoyu, and get bulk rice and things like that. And so anyway, eventually we got shut down because of the town said, you can't do that. So my mother went and got a storefront on Newbury Street in April 1966, and that was the first natural food store in the U.S. It's called Aragon, and she's the first person to use the word organic in selling food, and she went to local farmers and found the farmers which didn't use pesticides and stuff and started selling their produce and calling it organic. And she's the first person to use the word organic. So, and the second store she opened was Erewhon in Los Angeles on Beverly Boulevard. And Erewhon still exists actually in LA, in the Southern California area. And it's now considered the most expensive grocery store in the US.
Oh no.
Go in and get yourself a $20 smoothie. You know?
Wow.
But that's not, my parents sold that many years ago.
Yeah.
They weren't such great business people.
It's hard.
Yeah, they're more in it for the actual love of the food and the healthy culture. Yeah. So were there, because I know that so George Oshawa.
George Oshawa. Yeah.
Oshawa. George Oshawa. So he was influenced a lot by Zen Buddhism and Taoism, if I'm correct. And he knew a lot of esoteric practices and so on. Were you introduced to that kind of stuff or any of those currents when you were a kid?
No, we didn't talk really about some of those things. Mm-hmm. I would listen to George Ozawa when he would come. He would stay with us every year from 1959 when I was 4 years old. It was the first time he came over, stayed with us, and he would stay with us regularly after that. So until he passed away in 66, April 66. So he would say these things like, you're responsible for everything in the world, everything that's happening. And I didn't understand what he meant. And here I am, a little kid. But at the same time, there was some resonance with those words. So it took me till I got the cosmic joke to finally understand what he's talking about. So the other thing he would say is, there's only one disease. All diseases are a symptom of one disease, and he called it arrogance.
Mm.
And the another way that I recently heard someone else say the same thing or a similar thing, he says, you know, basically all disease is a symptom of victimhood. So I think he's pointing to the same thing.
So do you think he got the cosmic joke?
I think George Ozawa did. I'm not so sure about, I mean, I can't say. whether we get the joke or not, it doesn't matter. We're already there. You know, whether it's consciously seen or not. Yeah.
Well, I guess that in one way that's very helpful and soothing, but in another way it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just my mentality.
Well, if you look at it, you know, the key is to always be truthful.
Uh-huh.
You know, and unknowingly we're conditioned to lie to ourselves all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or like living for a future is a lie, based on a lie. You know, for example, there's nothing wrong with it, but we're identifying with this. Where you're identifying with something that's separate, and it's, you know, nothing wrong with it. Separate entity form that's labeled Isaac. You know, it's just that we're conditioned to think that that's what I am, and that's a lie. You know, so it's not that. So when I say we're conditioned to lie, I don't mean it. Lie is a negative thing. You know, so the once I got that life was not going to turn out, and I became, that's when I started actually looking at life in a much more truthful way. So we're looking at life through a fundamental lie that I am me, this separate thing. So because our reality is based on that, we don't realize that our reality is based on a fundamental lie. And here again, it's not that there's anything wrong with it. Once you see that, then we just play with it. It's not that we stop, you know, it's we just identifying with its ends. That's all. So you can conceptually understand what I'm pointing to when I say the eternal, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see that eternal is always here. It can never not be here.
Yeah.
So in that space, looking at eternal, you're being truthful when you say you don't get it, you don't see it. Perfect. You know, that's the place to begin. You know, what is it that doesn't get it? Right? So if you look at that, well, I don't get it. Who's the I? It's a pronoun. It's what. And of course, it's like the I can never get it because the I itself only is a temporary thing form, so it's never going to get it.
Yeah.
And then there's an identifying with that I is who I am.
Right. And then, like, what is it that is identifying?
Hmm. That's just the infinite plane. Indeed. So it's like when the toddler first learns to speak, when the toddler learns its name, et cetera, and it's this pronoun, or this noun, proper noun. The toddler doesn't get it at first, not the way we sophisticated adults get it. The toddler holds that noun like more like it's a teddy bear, like you give the child a teddy bear. And so now the child is walking around with his teddy bear. Oh, his teddy bear is hungry. So, and then eventually there's this, you know, like click, it forms, you know, it's begins to then identify, oh, that's me, you know, that's, I'm the teddy bear, you know, and then we get caught up in identifying with this separate thing and being a good teddy bear, et cetera. You know, I don't want, you know, I could please my parents or whatever. So, we then get caught in that identification. So in other words, if we look at language, when I say up, then automatically there's down, right? If I say good, there's automatically evil.
Right.
And, you know, and there's creating time, there's space, et cetera. So there's nothing wrong with it. Without the capacity for humans to language is, it's actually a creative. It's what makes humans creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I see the term made in the image of God is what that's pointing to, that humans language and languaging is a creative function.
Hmm.
So when I say me, then automatically I've now separated myself from what I'm not. And then identifying with that me, now I'm identifying with something that's separate from everything else. So it took Nutty Norio in the questioning of what does it mean to be human, to eventually see what language, what's thinking it. And then in the seeing what thinking is, and the thinking ending, that I saw that the me is only existing in language and thinking, in conversation. You know? Mm-hmm. And it's only that which then gives us a sense of separation. So it's not like I now identify with the infinite. If identifying totally ends, completely ends. Now I still play with identifying with, you know, otherwise, like I said, you know, we couldn't get together. We can't,
right. Yeah.
Tell each other stupid jokes and whatever. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that language is a contributing factor or maybe the cause of suffering? Like, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's not the cause of suffering, but suffering, right, wouldn't occur without language. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just thinking about you going up the hill on your bicycle and how you had that shift in perspective of like, if I just have a different attitude while I'm riding up this hill, then I won't be suffering as much. And so, yeah, I guess the thoughts do contribute to suffering.
Yeah, and it's not a different attitude. You know, it's so like, in other words, like I was speaking to someone the other day and someone said, okay, so instead of being thinking negatively, think positive. And I tell them, they're both the same thing, think negative.
Still thinking, yeah.
Well, they're also, yeah, if they're dual, if they're opposite, then they just support each other.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. One can't exist without the other. So
right.
Think positively, where we have to continually reinforce the negative as well.
Right.
So it's like the identifying with the heat, hill, whatever, just ended. No, that doesn't mean that I have this human form, so I'm susceptible to heat.
Yeah.
One time I was bicycling across the desert in Nevada and I almost got heat stroke, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. You know, but it didn't, I mean, you know, I could feel the heat, but I didn't think anything of it. You know, but mm-hmm. so I'm still susceptible to, it's not like all of a sudden I transcend the heat, or it's just no longer an issue. It's no longer something to suffer about. It's just what's up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before we wrap it up, what's the purpose of life?
We make it up as we go. Well, there's two purposes. Ultimate, mm-hmm. when we erase everything, the languaging and all that, you know, if we look at our forms, if we look at trees, we look at the plants, there's a life cycle that each plant has, you know, like from seed and seedling, you know, whatever, grows, matures, gives off fruit, whatever. And then, you know, so it goes from seed to maturity. So the human form also has a cycle of maturing. You know, it's born, and then, and like everything in temporary, in the world of temporary, it dies. So the purpose, so there's a natural maturation. The physical we can't escape, of course. You know, and then there's, of course, we as humans play in many arenas. We can divide up the different arenas we play in. So there's the physical, then there's the emotional arena. We can say that there's the spiritual as well. But so what I say is that our purpose is to flower. Okay.
Yeah.
So that is our purpose, is to flower. And each of us has a different way of what that looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So we're here to support each other in flowering.
Beautiful.
And what that means, so the only way I can support you in flowering is to understand and know you. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like to work that. So the function is to be totally open, no judgments, and understand, you know, who, what you are, and so be the space for you to flower, provided whatever space that is for you. And it's going to be, you know, so we're here to support each other's flower. So that's the purpose of our being human, or human form. And ultimately, really, what flowers is humanity as a whole.
Yeah.
And then we can actually take it a step further. What's really flowering is not humanity, it's the planet.
Yeah.
You know,
the cosmos. So,
yeah, and exactly. Conceptually, we can make all these divisions, mm-hmm. but in actually, it's just one flow. And that's one of the things that once I understood what there was a scene of what thinking is, and after 3 days, I began to see energy. I saw that rocks were energy. I saw everything was just energy. I could just see it. Mm-hmm. You know, when there's no using words to then freeze the energy into separate object.
Yeah, crystallize it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, so in our speaking, we're taking energy and then momentarily freezing, you know, into these objects.
Right.
Yeah, it's a kind of a mind blower, but it's fun.
Even just saying like the words freezing the energy or crystallizing the energy is freezing the energy and crystallizing the energy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I suggest is to live truthfully, to continue to live truthfully. And unknowingly, I mean, I didn't know it. Like, once I asked the question, what does it mean to be human? And as I'm driving the truck, and what you pointed out was meditation, I began looking at my whole life, like a recapitulation. And I saw my whole entire life what had been a lie. Because it's based on a fundamental lie. There's a separate me. You know, it's like a mind blower to see that. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like, and then to understand what suffering is, and when in seeing the cosmic joke, suffering, fear, all these things end, because it's seeing that those are just in identifying with this separate thing. And so once that occurs, well, of course you're going to suffer. Of course there's going to be fear. You know, I like to give people a clue that anytime fear shows up, we think it has to do with something out there. You know, that is causing fear. You know, something is attacking me, threatening me. Mm-hmm. But fear is a strictly human emotion or whatever. Nothing out there can create fear. The fear already exists within us in unconsciously, and something out there may trigger the fear to come to consciousness. And then we blame out there as the cause of the fear.
It's impersonal in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Like suffering is impersonal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, there have been circumstances, situations in my life where, you know, where my actual existence was threatened, but I felt zero fear. No fear whatsoever.
Yeah, I think of the mice that my cat catches sometimes. They'll fight back without any fear. Whatsoever. But there is another train of thought that I wanted to get to if you've got some time.
Yeah.
And this is about diet, because so your parents popularized the macrobiotic diet, which became this diet thing, you know, and I know that you, from your perspective, it was that was sort of like a secondary thing, the diet, but it was a very vegetarian diet, and people there are a lot of people who choose a vegetarian diet for spiritual purposes or for other purposes. And then this macrobiotic diet also one of the claims that I think your father made was that it would cure cancer, but then he did die of cancer, if I'm correct. So that's an interesting, a morbid cosmic joke in a way. But the other thing is, like, when I last saw you, we were both on the same diet, which was a keto diet. We're mainly eating meat and greens and so on, which has been helpful for me healing some things. And I know for you as well. But then I also recently saw in the news a woman who was on a raw vegan diet, who was only eating fruit, not drinking any water, and she died of starvation. And there just seems to be. Like diet can be very helpful for people and also cause massive problems for people. And obviously the standard American diet is terrible and anything that's different than that is probably good. But what are your opinions and viewpoints on diet at this stage in your life, after having been born in this situation and going through all the experiences so far?
Yeah. What George Osao was teaching, was about freedom. Mm-hmm. Really, his message was about freedom, liberation. Mm-hmm. And then the food was an aspect of that, of supporting that.
Right.
But it later became the be-all, end-all. That became, in 1965, George Osawa and my dad, oh, well, cancer is rising. Cancer may be a good way to introduce people to the microbiotics. Hey, we can cure cancer, do this, eat this way. And there are many people who did succeed in that. Yeah. So, I mean, I know hundreds of people who cured themselves of cancer as a result of, you know, however, it's not only food. The thing to really trust is our feeling, and not get stuck on the system. Oh, I can't eat this. I can't. I mean, George Osawa said, well, if you're healthy and you're free, you can eat anything.
Right. Yeah.
It's not about restricting anything. It's about playing. So cancer prevention diet, and that was one of his books. Different. And so for myself, the way I was raised, like, you know, I ate beyond with what I grew up with, which is, and so, but I have to say that I always ate consciously. I was always aware of what I was eating. And I think that's the big thing, is to be conscious of what you're eating, not to restrict yourself, but to be conscious. And that is, we want to eat foods which are natural, you know, not, you know, organic. Things that, the way that nature produces them, and not highly refined.
Right.
And so myself being raised in that way, like for example, you know, I've never had a headache in my life. You know, July 1968, I got chapped lips, and that's the only time I've ever had chapped lips. Wow. Over there. You know, last time, back in July, I had a stomach ache about 3 weeks ago. It was for about an hour. That's the first stomach ache I've had since August 73.
Wow.
So there's a benefit to being conscious of what we're eating in the way I was raised, around being conscious of food. Now, but for me, the way I lived was, I didn't restrict anything. I ate a particular way that I'm used to. Uh-huh. But here, like my sister, she passed away. She had cervical cancer. And then my mother also had cervical cancer. And then my dad, he had colon cancer. And so when I was diagnosed with this cancer in August 2021, you know, to me, it was like, okay. I mean, by May of 2021, I knew I had, looked like I had some type of malignancy. Mm-hmm. I already knew it. So I got it confirmed in August. But to me, it was like, okay, no big deal. It's what,
right.
It's up.
It's part of it's like the generational karma, like just the body karma, like, yeah, the genes are predisposed to it.
Yeah. So myself, like, I started shifting my diet once I recognized that this is something that is calling my attention back to the way I ate growing up, much more, you know, the way my mother fed. At the same time, you know, it continued to grow, this tumor. So, and to me, you know, I'm willing to say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what's what. And so, you know, I'm willing to listen to anything. And so I did went to Duke Cancer Research Center and, you know, followed some of their protocols, which, and does it work? I don't know. And then I went, one doctor I saw in January earlier this year was the one who recommended I do the keto diet. And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. You know, why not? and I had great results immediately.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's my pain level was cut in half. My leg, left leg was swollen, and 4 days shrunk right back to normal.
Wow.
So I asked him, well, how long do you want, should I do this? 2 years. I said, 2 years. All my favorite food. I'm not going to eat any of my favorite food. I said, all my favorite foods are not part of the keto diet.
Right.
And so I said, okay, no big deal. I'll do it. You know, I said, okay. So January 19th, 2025, I'll celebrate with an apple pie.
Nice. Nice. You know,
and a bowl of udon or whatever. But
yeah.
The thing is, our attachments, like addictions and stuff, is all in the talking.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's kind of the thing. A lot of people get attached to their diet. It becomes their identity in a certain way.
Yeah.
And unknowingly, because we think we are a separate thing, we continually go through life trying to refine what that is.
Yeah. You know, right.
Okay, I'm a good person. Okay, I'm now vegan. I'm now Christian, or I'm now whatever. Because we need to have something to identify with.
Yeah, something to hold on to. Yeah.
Yeah. And as soon as we're identifying with something, of course, there's something we're not.
Right.
You know, one particular religion. Whatever. So, like, my favorite, like, I enjoy it. Like, what I didn't realize when I was in school, I thought I hated reading. Mm-hmm. But once I left school, when I was 15, all of a sudden I realized I actually do enjoy reading. You know, so because I got to read what I wanted to read.
So, you weren't forced to read this, and
textbooks aren't fun reading.
So I used to love to go to bookstores and Barnes and Nobles or whatever. I like the small bookstore, the mom and pops. Totally. So the place I would always go to is the self-help section.
Mm.
You know, I read all these books on relationship, how to improve this, money, everything, every area of my life. Well, since getting the cosmic joke, I haven't stepped foot in the self-help section once. There is no self to help. There's no self to improve.
That's funny.
So you didn't write the book. Well, you helped write a book about your journey, Awake at the Wheel.
Yes.
And that if people are interested, that's a really fun book about your life.
It's written by a close friend who passed away recently, Stephen Earle, E-A-R-L-E. And the story about Noria. And it's an easy read.
Yeah,
it's nice.
And I met him in Japan in 1973. So we've been friends since then.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, so it's great that he wrote that for me. For us.
Yeah.
And the reader.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a very fun and enlightening conversation, Noria. I'm really glad that you took the time to do this.
Thank you.
If people want to find out more about you, is there a way to get in contact with you, or where would you direct people?
I have a website that has been inactive, but it's still there. Demystifyenlightenment.org or .com, either one. And then my oldest son just set up another website, Norio Kushi.
Nice.
So if you contact for that, even though it's inactive, the information is all very old.
You'd be able to get in contact with you that way.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, thank you, Isaac and AC. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, yeah, thanks, Norio.
You're welcome. It's been fun.